I'm gonna say this, you know, it's important for us to celebrate and love the people, the things that have inspired us while we have it.
So true. Indeed.
Because we take it for granted.
Like
we really do.
So hello, it's sunny in Leicester. That's not a nice view out of my window. Trees are turning. Definitely cold. Cold this morning, 8:05 when I was talking about the United Nations Sustainable Development Goal number 4 on quality education and its links to the recent Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report on a 1.5 degree temperature rise. Trying to make some links there. Anyway, I thought I wanted to talk about it a little bit more, maybe have a little bit of a rant about it, but I thought it was important we had some music to see us into that. My good friend Rob Wheel pointed me towards the Free Music Archive. I was kind of hoping he was going to make me something. Maybe you will. Maybe you. If you listen to this, if you're listening to this, Rob, make me something. I need an intro and an outro and some splicey bits in the middle. Anyway, been playing around, discovered Platters Act 7, the anniversary plate, which came out in August this year by The Silent Partner, originally from Luton, now in Massachusetts. I like the cinematic quality of that a lot. He's got a Tumblr, so it's THA Silent Partner on Tumblr for Gregory Davies' work, and I commend it to you. So, what was I going to talk? I'm talking about, and I want to sort of play around with some ideas really at the intersection of quality education, of that kind of sustainable development goal, and that recent IPCC report on climate change. Primarily because I'm trying to think about education as a vector at the level of the community for engaging in processes of mitigation and mitigation. That's a nonsense, isn't it, really? Of adaptation, ostensibly of adaptation. What do we do? Because this is the pedagogical project, right? At the level of society or at the level of the community, the level of the individual. I'm not at all sure how the university as a commodified and marketized space is able to help us deal with that. Certainly not sure how national educational sectors that are increasingly commodified are able to help us deal with that. So I've been thinking about that. It was kind of interesting, I think, looking through some of the underpinning background stuff around that sustainable development goal number 4 on quality education. It's got one as one of its targets. A lot of its targets are about literacy. They're about access to primary education, all the stuff we'd expect for there to be in there. Target 4.7 is on sustainable development and global citizenship. It's important or interesting that there's like, is it important? Is it interesting? Oh, I don't know. It was interesting to me anyway that there were 14 uses of the term climate in their 508-page report for 2017-18 on global education monitoring. 14 uses of the word climate in that report. Only 7 in the text. There are another 7 in references and in the appendices. 7 in the text, ostensibly referring to textbooks and the ways in which textbooks help us define a culture that engages intergenerationally with issues around climate change. It's kind of interesting, I thought. Also interesting in that report, the tensions that emerge between what it means to kind of develop an educational space or a set of educational sectors at the national and subnational levels inside a globalized structure for public management and the public management of funds that are based on very rigid forms of accountability. And to be fair to it, the report is really interesting in highlighting the interrelationship between systems, trust, assurance, how we hold individuals or groups responsible for failure, what mechanisms we have for corrective action. And it argues, it's quite interesting in arguing that in developing educational responses, this is like really difficult, isn't it? It's really difficult to design accountability mechanisms that emerge from socioeconomic, sociocultural, and socio-technical structures that are constantly being challenged by austerity, by the need to reduce your carbon, by issues around poverty. The report is interesting in kind of almost pushing back against performance management, pushing back against forms of new public management that we've seen certainly in the UK being pushed through deliverology and that kind of thing. They become a kind of a form of authoritarian imposition, really, of specific ways of managing what are seen to be black boxes, black box systems. And that tends to annihilate cooperation, solidarity. It tends to narrow the curriculum. It tends to push us towards teaching to the test. It tends to push towards the commodification of the individual, the subject, the item of content, the institution, in order that they can be financialized and marketized. So I think this report, this Global Education Monitoring Report from the UN, really interesting in enabling us to think about that separation at a very granular level, and how that repeatedly creates a competitive environment that marginalizes disadvantaged parents, disadvantaged schools, disadvantaged groups and communities, that it creates new forms of educational and social segregation, and that that is a, and that that is reinforced. We know that that's reinforced, for instance, through the Busan Partnership for Effective Development, which is driving the implementation of the UN Sustainable Development Goals. So there's a real tension here, I think, between the system and the human, which I found really interesting for me, just in terms of trying to think through what the options are, because we're told that we can universalize or create universal futures or universal imaginaries for quality education that impacts society. But at the same time, those processes of universalization marginalize the needs of individuals, the needs of groups, the needs of communities. They forget intersectional issues, intersectional injustices, intergenerational injustices, the injustices meted out to indigenous groups and indigenous societies, precisely because educational outcomes are reified, they're fetishized. We fetishize them as outputs from a system that we think can be modified cybernetically. If only we get the inputs right, we'll get the outputs right. And that's a real issue for us, I think. So, and for me, I've been thinking this kind of raised a few issues, because I've just written this thing on authoritarian neoliberalism and the development of a poetic epistemology. So thinking about the production of knowledge at the level of the community or at the level of society as a moment of poetry, picking up on Audre Lorde's Dismantling the Master's House. The authoritarian thing is really interesting in this moment, because that those ideas of accountability, those ideas of assurance, of treating this like a system that can be commodified, is reinforced, but through more authoritarian forms of neoliberalism that have been in particular instantiated in the last decade, since the crisis of capital first impacted. So we've developed structures that focus upon ordered economic liberties rather than democratic rights. We focus upon punitive, non-democratic, unequal reorganization of access to social goods like welfare, education, healthcare, and that we drive these around ideas of productivity. And we can't be willful or oppositional, as Sarah Ahmed argues. You cannot be willful in that space, because you are further marginalized, in that space. Beyond that, we have the fact that the market now drives everything. So the form, regulation, and governance of institutions, of data, of justice focus upon value, economic value, and not shared values, and that's a problem. We then have issues around the fact that we have the corporate parasitization of the state, which mediates power, and it also recognizes the corporation as the primary body with agency and rights, and that's an issue, I think, for us generating new forms of knowledge that may help us deal with crisis, because they're privatized, they're part of an ongoing process of driving economic value. And that process is driven by this idea of hegemonic masculinity, and also the methodological whiteness that Kamanda Bambara speaks about, which impose very specific norms on how we produce our life and how we produce knowledge about our life and what it means to be human. So again, we're forced into a particular black boxing of life as a system, where bodies that perform in that system have to comply with white male ableist cisnormative norms, and the everyday reproduction of that space, of the black box, disproportionately rests upon the labor of marginalized people, of women, of people of color. And obviously that is all reinforced through the authoritarian state. Kind of reminds me how, if we're trying to deal with issues around the Sustainable Development Goals or social change or social justice, I come back to Marx and Engels in the Communist Manifesto, arguing that the state is predicated upon governing the common affairs of the whole bourgeoisie, and no sector of the economy stands outside those common affairs. So we're being driven by those norms. So we get a kind of a mediation of knowledge production that might help us deal with crises, be they crises of austerity or crises of the environment, which we might argue is a crisis of austerity or crisis of capitalism at least. That knowledge, the very reality of authoritarian responses or an authoritarian proto-fascist restructuring of our everyday lives means that the ways in which we reproduce those lives and the knowledge that might help us move beyond those crises are disciplined through a division of labor, through punitive property rights, and the enforced scarcity of knowledge that we have to pay 9 grand to get access to in universities, or we have to pay for knowledge transfer into society. And this creates a kind of a new kind of common sense almost, I think, that is simply the latest reinterpretation of the subjectivity and autonomy of capital as a system of reproduction. And that's a real, I think that's a real problem. It's a common sense as a new, an ongoing reproduction of a particular epistemic reality, and that is governed by abstract mediations like the market, like around economic growth through the division of labor, through private property. And we need to think about what it is that we do in order to move beyond that as a critical pedagogic project. And for me, part of that is how do we usefully engage with indigenous and decolonizing struggles over knowledge production. And I think that's really interesting for me in terms of thinking about that recent IPCC special report on the impacts of global warming of 1.5 degrees. Chapter 5 is on sustainable development, poverty eradication, and reducing inequalities, talking about global action needed, talking about how local participation is crucial in addressing barriers, and that has to happen at multiple scales. Also then talking about the value of engaging with indigenous knowledge that can enhance different types of information sharing and build well, it talks about building resilience. I kind of hate that term. What even is that term? In this kind of context, it's kind of how do you enable individuals or groups to kind of overcome shocks and still be productive, be economically productive? In that transitions idea, it is more than that. It's about how do we maintain ourselves as functioning humans in the face of irreparable crisis to the way in which we currently reproduce things. So in this, I'm kind of interested in that idea of indigenous knowledge, of local knowledge that might enable differential intersectional understandings of the way in which education or the way in which social reproduction might happen. So that actually there's a really interesting case study in that IPCC report of the climate change adaptation program and an NGO in Vanuatu, which focuses on equitable governance, in particular pivoting on women's voices in decision making, thinking about connected programs underneath that address issues about rights-based education, social marginalization, domestic violence. Interesting that they focus on governance in that space around what transparency and accountability and community participation might be. But again, there's a risk here that we impose a perception of what that is as a structured thing from the global north, rather than seeing that the way in which it's located in the south might be different, in those indigenous communities might be different, and might offer us a different way of thinking about governance. I think it's interesting as well that they focus very heavily in the report on different kinds of literacies around energy literacy in particular, and that has an impact on political practices and political participation. But it's really interesting, again, for me, and really important that we think about literacy as a mutual project, that it is that it isn't just the imposition of literacy as a thing that someone internalizes and it makes them more resilient, that this is a dialogic, mutual, solidarity focused activity that is ongoing, that is always in process and in progress, and that always needs to be outed. So I think it's really interesting that the report focuses upon the need for literacy at the level of the individual, the family, the community, the nation, a global set of literacies, which focus upon building use, energy use, transport, forestry, oceans, food production. They think about decarbonisation, low carbon fuel switching, fuel efficiency, healthcare. But here there's a real need, I think, to pick up on what some of the literature has spoken about in terms of making this a bottom-up approach rather than the imposition of specific solutions predicated on productivity, on economic growth. So it's a deeply pedagogical project at the level of the community, at the level of society, and that's rooted in education, not for the sustainable development of capital, but for the sustainable development of humanity on this globe. So it has to deny accountability rooted in outputs and outcomes. It's got to focus upon the governance of communities along cooperative lines. I think that's kind of fundamental. So this has massive ramifications, I think, for the way in which we think about higher education. We need to ask about whether our certainly in the global north, I think there are questions for staff, students, for senior leaders, for the sector, about whether our emissions are sustainable, whether our energy use is sustainable, whether our governing principles are sustainable, whether our curriculum practices are sustainable, and whether the ongoing commodification and marketization of our educational lives are sustainable, because frankly they don't appear to be. There's a massive tension here, of course, because the IPCC report demands rapid engagement, whereas community development takes time. That's a real issue, and I'll come back to the kind of barriers to that in a minute. Let's talk about one of the barriers now. One of the barriers now is that it's still predicated. All of this is normalized under banners of growth and business as usual, which tend to marginalize specific communities, individuals and groups. It argues that we can still have fridges and daffodils. It argues that we can still have capital in its current form, runaway capital in its current form, and that we can somehow manage not to rip through 2°C. For me, it's kind of been interesting thinking about some of the kind of academic literature on this. My man Warren Pearce at University of Sheffield, who has worked quite a lot on making science public, and has worked quite a lot in the area of climate change and public engagement, pointed me towards some work which I'll bung in the blurb. Jan Selby et al. Talking about the complexities involved in this whole process, which are mutual and dialogic, that literacy development has to be dialogic, and also the work of Jonathan Cloak et al., who talks about challenging technocratic determination, the idea that the boffins will save us. We don't need to make decisions because the scientists, the socio-technocrats will save us, because they will be able to cybernetically engage with at an appropriate systems scale and develop universalized scalable delivery models that will somehow dig us out of this. And they argue instead for a focus upon social value and values, and thinking about energy systems literacy and project community literacy and political literacy. So part of the reason why I'm drawn to that, I think, is because it focuses upon agency and actors, local agency, local actors, thinking about collectively imagined energy futures as part of a new form of epistemological engagement rooted in shared knowledge, experience, aspirations, visions, where we're thinking about mutual learning, which encourages deviation from where we currently are. We don't impose things, we don't impose solutions, which then we can commodify and marketize and show impact. We think about local energy needs, what groups need, what communities need, what nations need, in order to rethink possible socio-technical imaginaries. So for me, this is really important. It's really important in engaging. If we're going to engage meaningfully with Sustainable Development Goal 4 on quality education, that can only have meaning where it disables the risk of intensifying the dominance of socially disconnected approaches that are technocratic, that are determined by outside actors, that are determined by white men, or the norms imposed by white men, and instead where we have a richer social connection, where we enable social values. And I think that's really important. And this kind of then finally links back to this paper I've been writing about a poetic epistemology as a response to an authoritarian reality of the ongoing reproduction of capital. This is important because that reproduction appears to lack validity, and this is one of the things that we've seen where a number of people have clearly not been enabled by through capital. We're 10 years into austerity. There's no end in sight. Capitalism has clearly failed swathes of the globe, and we've seen neo-fascism, proto-fascism come in its wake in a range of spaces. There's been a whole issue around survival of the fittest, which allows governments to tear up their energy commitments or ignore those energy commitments, because certain countries are have a utopian perception of their own ability to burn coal or burn their way through this issue. But the very fact that we're 10 years into austerity, there's no end in sight. We haven't been able to get stable forms of growth and accumulation back on track, make this an incredibly difficult moment now. The responses of institutions of the state, it seems, have become increasingly prosaic. They attempt to erase the poetry of life. And yet, obviously, the IPCC report says, I know that we've been in this long secular crisis, this long depression of capital, but we have 10, we have 12 years. We have to put the globe on a World War II footing, and we have 10 years to 12 years to sort this out. And that's really problematic, I think. That's really problematic. And I come back to Audre Lorde's words in this: for within living structures defined by profit, by linear power, by institutional dehumanization, our feelings were not meant to survive. And I think that there's a legacy here of patriarchy, and I'm drawn to responses that are queer, feminist, trans, disabled, that are subaltern, that are intersectional and intergenerational, that are indigenous. And I'm reminded in this that it's only in those othered and indigenous knowledges that we can move to an idea of knowledge that might define a new epistemic reality, an idea of knowledge that might help us engage with these crises that are beyond the market, beyond audit, beyond accountability, beyond property relations, beyond commodity exchange, that might describe a new poetic starting point for knowledge that reveals power and privilege and moves beyond it. And I think this is really important. This is really important because the crisis of capital is revealed to us in that IPCC report, and yet it's enabled an authoritarian pedagogical project at the level of society that repurposes social reproduction, social knowledge, social goods as commodities. And the commodification of our everyday existence is writ large. So I'm interested then, I think, here in looking at those processes of decolonization that might enable us to theorize this and develop a new form of kind of possibility, a new praxis that recenters the world But we don't have much time to do that, do we? Really? You know, we want to be in deep reciprocal conversation with our pasts, so that our present histories and identities are in dialogue with the past. We want to move beyond that, so that we can think about our relationship to a range of philosophies, of customs, of laws, of traditions, of values, of practices, to move beyond colonial imposition. And I think that that's a real, how we engage with that is kind of vexing me. How higher education, how education as a whole deals with that is vexing me. In particular, because the way in which primary through tertiary through adult education is currently structured, certainly in the UK, is about individuation. It is not about cooperation. It imposes a methodological claim to be neutral and progressive, and that growth can work through this. And so I come back to Audre Lorde's point about defining a new quality of light that works against the imposition of stuff. But again, there's a tension, isn't there? Do we have the time? Do we have the time? Do we have the time? So that's what I'm thinking about today. That's all cheery, isn't it? On a Friday afternoon, it's a little bit too long, isn't it? I wasn't intending to speak for 20 odd minutes, 26 minutes. Goodness, will anyone listen to this? Does it matter? Just wanted a little bit of a rant, really. So next time might be around the time of my book launch. We're having a book launch, so it might be around the time of that. There'll be a little bit of jibber jabber, I'm hoping, with my good friend Sarah Amsler, and it won't just be me chuntering on. But anyway, keep well, and see you soon. I should just say, I guess, that we're gonna have some closing music as well. We're gonna have some closing music that is from who is that for us? Ray Elbow, isn't it? Ray Elbow and the Magic Beans. From the new album, The Human Species, I'm particularly taken by the closing track, There Is No. So you can check them out on SoundCloud. Ray Elbow, that's R-A-E, Ray Elbow and the Magic Beans, new album, The Human Species. There will also be a link in the blurb, so make sure you check them out. Anyway, see ya.
was no liberation.
Yeah, very nice.
There is no liberation. There is no adequation. Cosmetic simulation. Continued objectification. There is no insurrection. There is no introspection. There is no introspection. There is no insurrection. Fascist infection. Political abjection. There is no absolution. There is no prosecution. There is no prosecution. There is no absolution. Religious assimilation. No final destination.
It's all just a digital construct.